Welcome to the Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast series. From Bitcoin to stablecoins and from smart contracts to decentralized finance, the age of cryptocurrencies, crypto assets, and all things crypto are becoming an integral part of our financial system. But these are all initiatives run by the private sector. Central banks, latecomers to this game, have also entered with their own digital currency, the CBDCs, Central Bank Digital Currencies. But what exactly are CBDCs? Who would use them? Do I need one? Who benefits from its existence? All this and more is the subject of what we will discuss in today's episode. My name is Maria Demergis, and I'm joined by two scholars who have studied the ins and outs of CBDCs. Josh Lipsky, who is the Senior Director at the Geoeconomic Center of the Atlantic Council, joins us today from Washington. Hi, Josh. So lovely to have you to the podcast series of Bruegel.
Thanks for having me.
And Gregory Claes, who is a senior fellow here at Bruegel, who joined us from Brussels and has written extensively on CBDCs, particularly the digital euro. Gregory, if I may start with you, and then we'll go to Josh with a little bit more details. Could you give our listeners a sense of what CBDCs are actually all about?
It's a difficult question. It seems like an easy one, but it's a difficult question because there are no universal definition yet of what a CBDC is. So easiest answer there would be that it's a digital form of central bank money. So basically, it's a digital form of cash. And I can give you actually the definition that the ECB gives of CBDC. And the way that they define it is it's an electronic means of payment issued by the central bank and accessible to everyone. That's the definition they give. We might come back to that definition later because I'm not even sure this is the most universal definition, but that's the definition that our central bank gives us.
So this is more or less like kind of a euro, but instead of it being in my wallet, it is actually in an app. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's an euro. It's like a coin or a bill, but in an app or an account.
Okay. And this is what the central bank of the euro system says, the ECB. Josh, anything to add on this coming from the other side of the pond?
I think that's a good definition. I think, you know, we typically think of it as a central bank liability, like paper cash. And of course, the natural thing everyone asked then was, well, what's the difference between my private money that I use every day that is electronic or digital versus this? And then as a financial people, we say, well, it's a different liability. It's a liability of the central bank versus the commercial bank. And the question, and we can get into that, is what difference does that make into life? But definitionally, I think that's how we think about it.
It's interesting you say, Josh, that is, you know, what difference does it make to our private money? Can we just rest on this point for a minute, just for the sake of understanding what we mean by private money? I think Gregory had actually described this very well. So the cash that we have in our pockets is actually issued by central banks, but the money that we borrow from banks, this is private money because it is the banks that actually issue it, right? However, the private money that we borrow from banks, they are backed by the central bank. They're backed by the sovereign in each country. The dollar is backed by the Fed and the euro is backed by the ECB. So it's not really all that private, right?
Well, it's, you know, it's private in the sense that in theory and the foundation of trust of the system is that it can always be redeemed for the central bank money in any situation. And paper cash is actually a manifestation of that trust. You know, you see these in times of financial crisis. People want to get money out of ATMs. They want the most solid fiat government-backed asset they can find. And I think that is actually one of the motivations here that we can get into. As people use paper cash less and less across a range of economies, do central banks feel that they have to offer an alternative to replicate that in the digital world?
Gregory, anything to add on this?
No, I think it's a perfect way to see this, actually. But if I may come back to one point, you say it's almost the same. I would say, yes, it's exactly almost the same because private money, the ones that we have on our bank account, might be slightly, even a bit slightly more risky in the sense that, for instance, if you have more than 100,000 euro on your bank account, then it's not backed by the state anymore. It becomes like a true liability of the bank. And if the bank fails, you are like one of the creditors of the bank like the other. So until 100,000 euro, basically, it's almost the same. After that, it's a bit different and it might be a bit more risky.
And what's that in the US? The equivalent of 100,000 the euro system of deposit guarantees? What is the amount in the US, Josh?
Yeah, so FDIC insurance and the bank would be roughly the same. But it's the same. It's the same issue in the U.S. that Gregory is raising.
That's right, and I mean, it's worth remembering that this amount has not been always so high. I mean, this number increased during the financial crisis when there was a real and very present danger for banks actually going bankrupt, and therefore there was a big kind of, you know, risk to the system, which in order to stabilize, they increased the deposit guarantee, right? So, okay, then let's go then to the central bank digital currencies. Can I ask, is it really equivalent to cash, Gregory?
It depends what form it takes, actually. There are different forms that are investigated. For instance, at the moment, the ECB is actually investigating two major forms. One would be money on an account, and this account could be held either directly at the central bank or through an intermediary that would hold these CBDCs. That's the first thing. And in that case, it looks more like the deposit that you have in your bank account. The second version, which would be more similar to cash and that they are also investigating, would be like some form of like peer-to-peer currencies that you hold, for instance, either on a prepaid card or on an app on your phone. And basically, it would not be centralized. It would be like very much like cash in a way, except that you would not use like paper and coins. What you would use is hardware that would be your phone or some form of a prepaid card. So they are trying to replicate that also because with cash, the main thing that we have and that we like is that it's fully anonymous. Well, if you have accounts at the central bank or at an intermediary, which might be a bank, for instance, then you lose that full anonymity. And people like that anonymity because you never know what can happen and who can hold this data.
But if it's stored somewhere, be it an app on your phone or, let's say, a card, can it be truly anonymous? And by that, I mean 100% anonymous. It could be 98% anonymous. But, I mean, there will always be a digital trace that will reach a name by the end of it or not. Josh?
Yeah, it's a good question. We work on this, and we did a report on this, cybersecurity and privacy and digital currency. You're right that it is not as anonymous as paper cash. I think that is just factually the case. However, what a lot of central banks do around the world is under a certain threshold, whether it's $500 or $1,000 equivalent in their currency, they basically tokenize and anonymize it. So you need very little information to access that amount of money. It could just be a phone number, can just be a name and birthday. And the idea here is that you are trying to give access to cash or the equivalent of cash in a relatively low dollar amount to mirror or simulate the usage that people have in everyday life. But once you get to higher amounts, authorities need to be able to have a way, if there's a risk of illicit finance, to track that activity, which is also the same in the U.S. on paper cash. If you spend more than $10,000 in paper cash on the U.S., Bank Secrecy Act in the U.S., Treasury can investigate that. Now, it's easier to do that through a CBDC system than it is through tracing paper cash, which is one reason my central banks and authorities could be interested in it from that perspective.
Mm. So what you're saying, Josh, is that the authorities, the central banks, can now take advantage of the technology, the distributive ledger, the blockchain, to try and mimic the properties of the paper cash, but they'll do it digitally, right?
Exactly. And there's also an opportunity to improve upon paper cash. And this, you know, this is kind of the motivation of central banks. We talk a lot about competition from crypto and stablecoins, and you raised this in your opening. That's certainly a motivation. And there's no doubt, if we go back to the history of CBDCs, the Libra project from Facebook in 2017, 2018 as a global stablecoin motivated a lot of central banks to say, well, hold on a second. If there's going to be a global stablecoin from a private company, we may need to have an option here. But there's another motivation, which is, can I deliver fiscal or monetary policy faster, more efficiently using technology? And do CBDCs and distributed ledger give me an option to do that? Open question whether that can work, but central banks are interested in finding out the answer.
Mm. Open question indeed, because the next question I was going to come to you is, exactly what problem do CBDCs actually solve?
I think Josh's points was very important. Originally, the main problems that the central bank wanted to solve was they were afraid of Facebook and Libra, and they might have been also afraid of China, who is also developing very quickly CBDC. That's the main reason, in my view, why they started discussing this. Something else that Josh already said is also very important, is that if cash disappears, basically, citizens lose access to public money. And so this convertibility that we were discussing before between private money and public money disappears. And I think central bank, they really highlight that point. I think it's very important. But it's, in my view, more important in theory than in practice, actually, because in practice, people do not really see the difference between the money that they have in their normal bank account. And if they had an account in an intermediary of CBDCs, for them, it would be very difficult to distinguish the two. I think CBDC is demanding a bit from normal citizens. Normal citizens, they don't really care about the difference between private and public money that much.
I mean, it's interesting you raise this issue of cash disappearing, because one of the countries where payment systems are the most digitalized, which is Sweden, had actually experimented with doing away completely with cash. Completely. And actually discovered that there will always be a minimum amount of demand for cash. And I mean actually paper cash, because I mean you can use digital forms of payments in different ways. But actually there is something about having money in the pocket that fulfills a set of purpose that will not be replaced by a digital currency that is issued by the central bank. So that actually makes the whole thing even more confusing, certainly for consumers, in terms of what exactly will you do differently and how would I benefit?
Well, you ask a question that many ask around the world on Capitol Hill. We get this question a lot in the administration, Federal Reserve. I agree with Gregory's points. And, I think from a euro perspective, ECB President Lagarde has said she does not want paper cash to go away either. She has made that point clearly. So it is about a new addition, a complement, another tool, as opposed to replacing paper cash. But let me give another reason why I think central banks are interested in this. And we are talking about retail, and then we'll talk about wholesale in a minute. But in the US, if you go to a coffee shop, if you go to, a store, oftentimes, if something costs less than $5, which is harder and fine in the US these days, but if something costs less than $5, you can only pay in cash. And the reason for that is that the merchant has costs associated with the credit card transaction fees, and it's not worth the merchant's expenses to take less than $5 in a credit card because of the fees they pay. So something that happens in the financial system in the back end of the plumbing, which we don't see every day, is a lot of friction. There is delays between settlement between banks. Sometimes it takes hours, sometimes it takes days. Money is lost in that time. Money is lost between banks, money is lost between merchants, and those costs actually end up getting passed back on to us through credit card fees, through higher cost when you're paying for things. You can reduce potentially friction in the financial system through closer to instant settlement. And that is the actual technological advantage that this can provide. There are a lot of concerns to ask yourself, well, would that really be delivered through a CBDC? But when we think conceptually what a CBDC might be able to do, that's one motivation.
But can I ask you, Josh, this is, or Gregory, please come into the conversation. Friction, if I may summarize what you just said, is the existence of frictions, right? And then, the central bank digital currency can actually remove these frictions, which are costly to the consumer. And as you described, we have similar things in Europe, but actually in different forms, depending on which country you are and the systems that we have. But why do you need a public solution to something that could be solved privately? Why is there a need for a taxpayer to come in and solve this problem? And actually, you could develop either more competitive markets on the payment system or just, find a way of reducing the cost of friction.
Well, I'll start and then Gregory, please. I would say that there are private sector companies who already say we have a digital dollar. Circle is one of them. They're the issuer of USDC, US dollar coin. And they say we don't need a central bank digital currency from the Fed because we are backed one by one to the dollar. It's a stable coin. It can settle near instantaneously. So to your point, Maria, we have it. And I think a question a lot of regulators ask in the wake of Terra Luna, in the wake of FTX is, well, is that true? Is that safe? Where are your books? Are you liquid? And so this is where a government steps in as a public option, as a backbone, as a standard setter to say the private sector can do this, but we also see a role for a government to play here as one option in the system.
Yeah, now to be honest, actually on the instant payment system. We have one in Europe since, I think, 2018. The ECB and the Eurosystem build one. It's called TIPS. And basically, you can do instant payment between banks of the Eurosystem almost for free, 24 hours per day.
We're envious of that system here.
So actually, it's already there. And so the friction is quite small, to be honest, in the Eurosystem about that. And it's true that we still pay, actually, for those instant payments. But the European Parliament is actually working on a piece of legislation saying that banks should not be allowed to make us pay for that. So the friction is going to be reduced by legislation directly. So it's true that when you have this, I'm a bit skeptical that we can improve that. This because a centralized instant payment is the most efficient way. And we know that most DLTs that are used, the one used by Bitcoin, but other DLTs, are generally less efficient, both from an environmental perspective, but also in terms of speed. So I'm still a bit agnostic or even a bit skeptical about improving on that.
I am a little bit kind of puzzled by this discussion on the sort of the instant payments and how important it is to the consumer to be able to have this instant payment. I mean, the payments are instant. When we go to the shop, we pay and immediately we get the goods that we buy, right? So I think in that respect, as far as I'm concerned or any consumer's concerned, it is an instant payment. However, it's not an instant settlement in the sense that it has to go through the system. And I think that reducing that time to zero is not accurate because it doesn't reflect the fact that there is a risk that needs to be managed. By the time my money comes out of my account and goes to the account of the merchant whose goods I have just bought, this is a transaction that requires some time to be settled, you know, that I have money in my account and therefore that needs to be taken out and given to somebody else. So this idea that we're going to reduce the settlement time to zero is, in my view, misleading of the fact that it requires some assessment of risks in the process of making the transaction. And I think this is something that we are confusing here. I think there is a service that is being done in the settlement that cannot be eliminated. Otherwise, it will not be able to clear, to settle the transactions that we have. We have Target 2 in Europe. You have the same clearing system in the US, where all transactions are legitimized by the sheer fact that it goes through the system. It's almost like a bank blockchain, right? It's written from one side to the other. So I just don't think that this distance can be eliminated. It can be reduced. And that's the friction story. Back to what Joe said about frictions. And, you know, if it is about reducing frictions, why don't we find a private solution? What is the externality that the public authority, a central bank, is come to solve and not convinced yet that we have found it?
I'll just say two things. One, you know, I was very careful to use the term near instant settlement, specifically for the point you made, Maria, because we don't want instant settlement for risk reasons. And both on the wholesale side, too, where there's, and we'll talk about wholesale CBDC, exactly, where there's been more action, actually, than the retail side. And there we're talking about bigger amounts where you really have to mitigate risk and you cannot have instant settlement. But we do sometimes have T1 or T2, 1 or 2 days in settlement time in the U.S., and that can certainly be reduced safely. So you do not need 24 or 48 hours. We don't have our FedNow system up and running yet in the U.S., but there are things that can't be serviced over the weekend. Again, we look to Europe as a model here, as something we will try to, you know, catch up to. So there are serious frictions that can be reduced in the system. Hmm. But when we were talking about a CBDC, we talked about the crypto piece of it, but we haven't talked as much about the pandemic. And I think the pandemic is an important motivator for our CBDCs and the adoption of CBDCs, because governments spent an extraordinary amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus, a historic amount that has never been spent before. And one thing we realized in the US, and I think many authorities realized around the world, is they have inefficient delivery mechanisms for their government to citizen transfers. We were waiting weeks for stimulus checks in the US. There were bank cards sent out. And there is a way through CBDC, potentially, technologically, to deliver that. So one way I see a retail CBDC is actually where government to citizens interact. Stimulus, unemployment, taxes. When you're doing the direct government to citizen interactions, it makes sense to me to be using public money for those exchanges and using private money for everything else.
Can I ask you a question, actually? Do you think that it should be done with accounts at the Fed, for instance?
No. So, and you know, this is one thing we study at the council, is that every CBDC around the world, and there are 105 projects around the world, are intermediated. So one of the myths about CBDCs is, oh, we're going to disintermediate. I'm going to have a Fed app on my phone. I'm going to have an ECB app on my phone. It has never been done in practice, even in China. they intermediate through their commercial banking system. So that tells us that, you know, the banking system will not be disintermediated. They need the banking system because the Fed can't handle hundreds of billions of customers, right? The last thing Chair Powell wants is, you know, the Fed to be answering a call at 2 a.m. because someone forgot their password. This is not something the Fed is equipped to handle. So it will be done intermediated. It will be done through accounts. And then I think the natural question is, but have you then undercut the benefit by intermediating the system? And this is the debate, you know, we're having in the U.S. But from an AML KYC perspective, from an account handling perspective, I really believe it will be done through the banking system, but an expanded umbrella, not just the Bank of America's in the US, but a wider network of private fintech service payment providers might now have access to the Federal Reserve or central bank than they had before.
I was going actually to mention the last point that you made, because actually what they say, and I think their main argument today is really that we need public money to be an anchor for trust in money. And basically that's what paper money provides. Like when you lose trust in the financial system, in financial institution, you go back to paper money. That's what we see when we observe bank runs. However, having like CBDC stored in an intermediary, doesn't it defeat the purpose? So basically, I don't trust Bank of America. I'm just saying Bank of America as an example, because I don't know, there is a problem in the banking sector, but I with my normal deposit, but I will trust them to hold my CBDC. That's a bit weird in my view. In my view, basically this anchor thing and the need for CDBC as an anchor is that I need to have access in extremis to public money. I don't need public money every day. Like actually I don't have public money on me. I don't use cash almost anymore, but I want cash to exist because if everything fails, then I can go back to cash. So having all these things about like being able to do payments on a daily basis with CBDC, I'm not that sure it's useful in the end. I don't need it on a daily basis. I need it in extremis when I lose trust in everything. And when I lose trust, I don't want Bank of America or whoever to have this money for me.
But Gregory, it comes back to the deposit guarantee, because as you say, in extremis, if something bad happens, in the current situation, the government in every single Eurozone guarantees that I have access up to 100,000.
If you see it that way, the public guarantee on private money makes it very near to CBDC.
Exactly. So again, back to which purpose? I mean, if you're telling me that, oh, perhaps I could have more than 100,000 in the central bank, then actually that becomes interesting again, because then I could guarantee more of my cash if I had more than 100,000. But the center, at least in the Eurozone, the amount of cash you will have is, what is it, Gregory?
It's small, actually. The ECB is trying to constrain that. They don't want you to hold a lot of money on your wallet, on your phone or on a prepaid card. This is going to be very small because it's going to be only there to do small amount of payments. And even if you have an account, it's also going to be small because they fear this intermediation. So basically, it's going to be small.
Can you walk us through this disintermediation argument? Because I think that's an important argument for our listeners.
Yeah, but basically the idea is that if I can hold CBDC instead of holding private money in a commercial bank, why would I keep my money in a commercial bank? Especially as a French citizen like me, where banks don't pay a lot of interest rate on their deposits, I would prefer to hold it fully at the central bank, and then nobody would make any deposit in the commercial bank, and commercial bank would need to find other way to finance themselves. So I think that's kind of problematic, and that's why I'm still very skeptical about CBDC, because what they are trying to offer us, or at least what the ECB is trying to offer us, maybe there are other good reasons to have CBDC, is to offer us a public means of payment. I don't need a public means of payment. Actually, as you said, I'm pretty fine with private means of payment. What I need is a public store of value. And this, they don't want to provide it to us, because if they were going to provide it to us, then this intermediation could happen. So in my view, yes, CBDC could actually be very radical, but because they are afraid of the potential risk, they are going to make it very small and, in my view, not that useful.
However, it would be quite different, wouldn't it, Josh, if it were to go to the wholesale funding, right? To the wholesale CBDCs, right?
Yeah, and this is an important distinction. We've been talking about retail CBDC, how we all buy a cup of coffee, use a CBDC equivalent to paper cash. But really the most action, and this has really picked up since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and we can talk about why, has been on the wholesale CBDC side. And we track this at the council. There's been a tripling of the number of projects cross-border on wholesale CBDC, by which we mean bank-to-bank transfers. And there is a real use case, Maria, to your question, because there has been a use of the international financial system, the dollar-euro international financial system, to sanction, to take Russia off of that system. And a series of countries, not just China, are very interested in exploring alternatives to that system in terms of correspondent banking relationships. How can they transfer money between banks quickly if they were cut off of the current dollar-euro-based international financial transaction system? And that's wholesale CBDC.
Exactly. So that brings us to something that's very interesting. I know that you have a very interesting, a very comprehensive tracker at the council. Can you tell us a little bit the state of play when it comes to the development of CBDC across the world?
Yeah. And so we've been doing this project for 2 years. You can find it at Atlantic Council CBDC tracker. When we started the project, we were looking at 35 countries who were exploring CBDC. 2 years later, we're at 105 countries and currency unions that are exploring CBDC. And one question we often get asked by the Federal Reserve and Treasury is how many countries are serious about it? Because it's one thing to issue a press release, I'm doing CBDC. It's another thing to spend a lot of money. There are now 50 countries that are in what we categorize as a serious phase of exploration, meaning they're past research. They're in development, pilot, or fully launched. And that includes 16 of the G20 economies. So another thing you hear about CBDCs is, oh, it's smaller economies. The Bahamas is doing it. It's beyond that now. It is not just small economies. It's a range of advanced, emerging, and low-income countries that are interested in this for different reasons. And when we think of the big four central banks, the ECB and the Bank of Japan are in development, and the US and the UK are still in the research phase. So this has been some of the developments we've seen. And the wholesale side, as I said before, has really picked up over the past 7 months. But the top line is that 95% of the world economy, you know, measured by GDP, is exploring a CBDC. And many countries, including Nigeria, China, are really at the fully launched or close to fully launched phase.
But am I right in thinking that the US still remains to be convinced?
I think that's fair to say. The US remains to be convinced. They did announce a few weeks ago, this got lost in the FTX news, that they are now developing a wholesale CBDC project with the Monetary Authority of Singapore. And that was the first time we had seen really CBDC experimentation. That's out of the New York Fed, which makes sense because they're the ones who are owning the relationship with the banks in New York. And they are now exploring wholesale CBDC. But it's very fair to say that they remain to be convinced, especially on the retail side. And there would have to be congressional authorization and legislation before any issuance of a US CBDC.
If I may, I want to encourage everyone to go to your website because I really love the tracker. I think it's really well done. But I wanted to highlight something actually that I noticed on your tracker is that I think 11 countries that have launched a CBDC are all very much emerging market economies. And it's and I think in my view they have done it for a reason that we have not mentioned yet, because I guess we are a bit too US Euro-centric given where we live, is that one reason that we didn't mention to have a CBDC is financial inclusion. The fact that in the US and in Europe, everybody has a bank account, but it's not true in some of the countries where a CBDC was launched. So it was a way to bank the unbank, to mention what Mark Zuckerberg said when he tried to launch Libra. So I think financial inclusion is not very relevant for us, but it's relevant in the country where it was launched.
I would just add one thing to that. It's very true. You know, emerging markets, China has, you know, probably 100 million people now using a CBDC. We can talk about their project. But one thing I see from the ECB, from the US, from the Bank of England, there's a keen interest in being international standard setters in this space while things are moving quickly in other economies. Meaning that these countries who use the euro and the dollar and issue the euro and the dollar want to make sure that CBDCs that are used around the world, whether they issue them or not themselves, protect privacy, have cybersecurity standards. That's of interest to global financial stability. And we see the Fed being more active on that front at the G20 and the BIS and the IMF than they've been before.
No, that's absolutely right. Thank you, Gregory, for raising this issue, because, you know, I often sort of, you know, get asked this, what difference would it make in a financial system like the European financial system or the US financial system? And the answer was very little by means of offering me different services or better services. But it is true that in other jurisdictions, you can actually bypass the banks who actually often refuse to open bank accounts because they have to do a due diligence on the risky profile of the clients, right? If I may shift a little bit to a different argument, and actually, Josh, you actually raised it in passing when you said that the Russian invasion in Ukraine has actually given rise to a need for an alternative means of payment. Can you walk us through that and how CBDCs actually fit in this more geopolitical context?
Right. So in the wake of the invasion, we saw an unprecedented sanctions regime from the G7. And a big part of that sanctions regime was cutting several Russian banks off SWIFT, freezing of FX reserves. So it's unprecedented for the G7 to do this against the G20 economy. And the way it happened, how quickly it happened, and the implementation of it raised eyebrows around the world, not just in Russia, but in countries like Malaysia, India, South Africa. And these countries were already thinking about wholesale central bank digital currency. So what is the benefit to them of a wholesale system? What a wholesale CBDC can do is create near instant, important to say near instant settlement between other banks. Now, the reason we go through a euro dollar based international
central banks, you mean?
Well, central bank liabilities that the commercial banks are accessing.
Okay.
But the reason we go through this euro dollar based financial system for currency settlement all over the world is because it's stable and it's liquid and it provides security. And there's a historical tradition of settling usually through the dollar, touching the dollar at some point, even if you're converting two currencies that are non-dollar currencies. But CBDC, by reducing that transaction time and risk and reducing the volatility, means that countries might be able to go currency to currency outside the dollar. So if you're a country like India or Malaysia or South Africa, and you were worried at some point about becoming on the wrong side of a U.S. sanctions regime for whatever reason, this is a hedge for you now. Because now you say, well, if I ever get cut off of this Swiss system that I'm now overly reliant on for my commercial banks, I will have an alternative to still have access for my commercial banks to settle cross-border with other commercial banks in other countries. And that's where wholesale CBDC comes in. There are other options. Wholesale CBDC is just one, but we've seen an increase in money spent on this in the past 7 months. And I always say central banks are cautious institutions. And when they spend $15, $20 million over a period of 8 months, 9 months, that tells me that they're serious about this, that they would not use that money if they didn't really want to develop this technology.
But just to be clear on this, just to clarify, so take the example of the sanctions on Russian banks. They will cut off the SWIFT system. I remind you, the SWIFT system is just a messaging system. And actually, at the beginning of the sanction period, the Russian banks found other ways to message banks in the Western world. And it took a little while before the whole thing came into effect. But what you're saying is Russian banks, let's suppose we had CBDCs, Russian banks had liabilities in, let's say, in the Chinese bank, and then they could really, in the Chinese central bank, then they could actually settle directly with Chinese banks via Chinese CBDC.
Conceptually.
But they would not be able to clear with the digital euro or a digital dollar,
exactly,
because they would be under sanctions. So in fact, that would create an incentive for a sanctioned entity to promote the creation of CBDCs in their own jurisdiction, such they can continue functioning with friendly nations in the event of being sanctioned.
Which is one reason it's very interesting that SWIFT is now developed, and they're spending a lot of money on developing a multi-country cross-border CBDC exchange platform. Not just messaging, but actual exchange of the currency themselves, precisely because of the reason you're saying, Maria.
No, but I agree with your point, Maria. I think, yes, the upside is that for the EU, for instance, it could make us more autonomous from the US in a way. Like, now we agree to sanction Russia, but at some point we disagreed on sanctioning Iran. And the European companies, because they were using SWIFT and the dollar system, basically, they had to comply with US sanctions. Now, if we sometimes disagree with the US, of course, the US are our great ally, but sometimes we have some disagreements. And if we disagree, if we build a network of CBDC with other countries, we could go on in our way. The bad thing, and you also mentioned it, Maria, is the downside is that countries like, let's say, bad regime could also create their own network and completely exclude us from that network, and so circumvent the sanction that Europe and or the US are putting in place.
And China just tested this technology recently. Yeah. They did 22 million in settlement between Thailand and the UAE, and that was the first cross-border wholesale CBDC that had actually been settled in real money, not just a test.
Whereas previously, in this example, it would have to go through SWIFT and therefore in the international financial system and potentially blocked had it been an aggressor.
And if not SWIFT, to your point, Maria, then at least touching a New York or a London or a European bank somewhere along the route that would make it impossible to do the transaction.
But now I'm beginning to understand why the US might not be so keen on this, because that means that the US is actually losing control of any more international financial system. But is the answer to that not engaging into its own CBDC?
So I believe the answer to that from a US perspective is to develop its own CBDC model, regardless of whether we issue one for our domestic economy, meaning that as the issuer of the world's reserve currency and a promoter of global financial stability, the Fed has a responsibility to bring to market a CBDC, as we talked about, that has privacy protections, that can be safe from cyber attack, and say, we don't know if we are going to issue this. But if we ever do, it's important that you be interoperable with the dollar. I think if that project was undertaken in coordination with the Bank of England and the ECB, most countries in the world would make sure they met those standards, similar to correspondent banking and AML KYC standards, because they know they have to be interoperable with those currencies to function in the global economy.
So, but effectively, we are talking about new developments in the world of wholesale CBDCs that touch on issues of geopolitics. And in fact, it's not just politics, it's the weaponization of finance, right? And how we can actually use that or abuse that in the context of a more polarized world, right? On the retail side, I think we are more converging that, at least in this part of the world, there isn't really much of an innovation here. In other parts of the world, there is much more of an inclusion that actually justifies the creation, right? I think the fact of the matter is that the blockchain technology and the ledgers have given us an opportunity to find out what we think about this new technology and how we can incorporate in the financial system. Okay, I actually think we're coming to the end of the time. Would you have any final thoughts? Gregory, perhaps I can start with you. I mean, are you excited about seeing the project of an electronic euro coming to your app?
As you might have noticed, I'm still a bit skeptical about it. But I was happy when the euro was born. I remember I was a kid and I was happy to see a new currency. That's maybe why I became an economist. So I'm always excited about those things, let's say, from a personal point of view. However, I don't think it's going to be life-changing for us. But I think, as Josh said, actually, it's good that the ECB is working on it. I think it's good to have it on the shelf. Maybe the ECB want to do more than putting it on the shelf. But let's see, actually, the decision itself is far from now. They are going to decide only at the end of 2023 if they are going to launch a pilot, and then it's going to take at least 2 more years. So anyway, it's far remote, but it's good that they work on it, that they do research about it, that they do research on the design, etc. I think it's good to have, but maybe we don't need to put it in place in the end. It's more like a defensive thing.
Josh?
Well, I want to thank the ECB as well, because they've motivated the Fed. And so one thing that was very interesting to me was that when the new vice chair of the Federal Reserve, Lael Brainard, came in, her first testimony to Congress was about CBDC, about a range of topics we have going on in the world, supply chains, inflation, monetary policy. It was about CBDC. And she mentioned the ECB 9 or 10 times and mentioned ECNY, China's digital currency, once. And I think that's very interesting in terms of how the Fed thinks of friendly competition with the ECB. So I think the ECB has actually done a lot in this space to have other large central banks think about what this means for their own fiat currencies. The final thing I would say is that central banks get to innovate too. The private sector should innovate and use distributed ledger technology and all the advantages it might be able to bring. But central banks have innovated throughout their history. We have different payment systems in the US, ACH. Now we're bringing on FedNow. And I think it's perfectly reasonable. It doesn't have to be revolutionary from a Federal Reserve perspective to just be an incremental improvement if it achieves that. And a CBDC offers that option.
Wonderful. That's great. I think that we're coming close to the end now. I think this has been a wonderful discussion. Gregory and Jos, thank you so much for joining us today on this. We will be watching this space, and I encourage all our listeners to visit, as Gregory said, the tracker at the Atlantic Council. It's really very well updated, and it's a wonderful visualization of the activities of CBDCs across the world. Many congratulations for that. For the moment, thank you very much both for joining us. And to our listeners, you can find all our material on the Bruegel's webpage, www.bruegel.org. That's all we have time today. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.